hospital wedding vows, nurse practitioners in Australia, and nurse veterans. Plus, we're going to review CBC Labs this week. If that's what you're looking for, you found it. It's The Nursing Show. Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I'm your host, Jimmy Davis, and I'd like to welcome you to the show this week. If you'd like to find out more information about The Nursing Show, check out all of the articles and other information that are posted throughout the course of each week over at our site. Head over to nursingshow.com. You'll find links there to the show notes right at the top of the page where you can follow up on any of the information discussed in this or any other episode. Of course, you can also find links to our video episodes over at that site, or you can go directly to nursingshow.tv. Those are all our episodes are now produced on video and audio versions as well, so you have an opportunity to watch and listen to the show and however you'd like to. We also have links there for the Nursing Show newsletter, which I urge you to sign up for. You get the links from each episode sent to you each and every week, along with other occasional information through the course of the month. And of course, get back in touch with me by leaving comments there on any of the links. You can also reach me directly. Send us an email into nursingshow@gmail.com. That's right, nursingshow@gmail.com. And let me know what you'd like to hear in a future episode. Maybe you'd have a suggestion or a comment on a recent episode. And of course, any corrections you might have. Look, I'm going to make mistakes, so it's up to you as part of the Nursing Show community to make sure that the information that I present here to everyone that's watching or listening is the best possible information for nurses each week. And if we have any corrections that we need to make, I want to make sure that we make those available as soon as possible. So send those corrections in. Again, that email address is nursingshow@gmail.com. Finally, don't forget to catch up with me over on Facebook or Twitter. You can follow me under the handle PodMedic, and that means you can go to facebook.com/PodMedic to become a friend on Facebook, or also over following me on Twitter, twitter.com/PodMedic. And don't forget to become a fan of The Nursing Show, facebook.com/nursingshow. Click on the like button there right at the top of the page and become a fan of The Nursing Show. I post questions, other links, and things over at the Facebook fan page that I don't put on the regular Nursing Show site, and I may not discuss everything here in the show each week. So the fans get a little heads up on some great links and resources. I ask the fans their questions for future episodes and all sorts of other things posted over at the Nursing Show fan page on Facebook. So make sure you take advantage of that resource there. Time now to jump on into this week's news, and I'll be checking out on the monitor over here in just a sec. But I want to start off with a great news story I picked up out of the Baltimore region near where I live, and it is from a local hospital that had a patient coming in for cardiac catheterization, a critical care unit patient that was scheduled to attend his wedding. A veteran of the U.S. Air Force and preparing to get ready to have his wedding at the Annapolis Yacht Club when he was rushed to the hospital a few days before for some cardiac complications and ended up having a cardiac catheterization. He was still in the critical care unit at the hospital when the day for his wedding rolled around. So, you know, nurses being who we are, we figured out that there was a way to meet this patient's unique needs in this special situation and try to help them maintain some life normalcy. In this case, something very unnormal, I guess, a wedding. So they actually had the wedding at the hospital in the lobby. 40 members of the friends and family that were originally invited to the larger wedding were there in attendance, and they were able to exchange vows while he was sitting there attached to his heart monitor with his nurses around him. Now, I know there were a lot of other people associated with this particular situation from the hospital staff, and of course the hospital PR people have leapt on this as a great way to promote the hospital, but I think the most important thing here is just to recognize that many times the most powerful interventions that we as nurses provide for our patients are those interventions that are deceptively simple. and non-medical in nature, because we are helping these patients have some level of life normalcy through the course of their illness, surgery, recovery, whatever the case may be, by providing them access to things as simple as helping them to remember to plug in their phones so that they can remain connected with loved ones while in the hospital stay. Just simple little things that help these patients remain connected with their lives outside of our facilities. And it is these simple interventions that nurses perform every single day that I think lives at the core of what nursing care is. And this is just a big, broad explosion of one of those interventions with a huge event like a wedding. But it can be many little simpler things that occur. And so, you know, kudos to these nurses for being able to put something like this together and coordinate something special for one of their patients when it was available to do so. And I would just remind you to take a few moments every day, think about each of your patients, and try to think of some way, even a small way, that you can help them maintain connection with their life outside of your facility. And so I just want to congratulate these nurses. This is Anne Arundel Medical Center's critical care nurses and staff, and of course the hospital staff in general, for coming up with a great way to keep this patient's spirits up and up the patient themselves uplifted for something as important as their wedding day. Next up is an article I picked up coming out of Australia. This article actually is over at medicalnewstoday.com. And it's an article that is a response from the Australian Medical Association. Yeah, they have an AMA too. And the Australian Medical Association is responding to the changes and the adoption of their nurse practitioner primary care model in Australia. Australia is implementing nurse practitioners using a very similar model to what we have here in the United States. Talking to other nurses, this seems to be about 10 to 20 years older than our model as far as how young the system is for them. And so they're reaching some of the same hurdles that we had here as nurse practitioners began to assert their abilities to provide basic primary care services to patients at a very cost-effective and in a very healthful way for those patients and giving them proper holistic nursing care at a very high level. So the doctors, of course, are concerned that these nurses would be autonomous in some way, that they would not be able to control them. And this, you know, we've seen these kind of things every time Nurse Practice Act changes come up in every state here in the U.S. But in Australia, they're still struggling with trying to get these laws and systems enacted. Now, these nurses are really trying to find ways to serve underserved parts of the Australian community. So the arguments used by the physicians here really ring rather untrue. If there were enough physicians to cover all of these remote rural areas of Australia, they'd be there. Or if there were enough physicians that wanted to work in these remote rural areas, they'd be there. Nurses are willing to go into these areas and provide primary care services. And, you know, nurse practitioners are able to refer people who need higher levels of care to the appropriate medical specialists. So they're not really taking anything away from the physicians. There just aren't enough primary care professionals in the physician space to provide the services that are needed. And nurse practitioners provide a great opportunity to give these patients a next level of care and a broader and more holistic level of care than many primary care physicians might provide for them. So I'm excited to see this initiative move forward, despite articles and press releases from the organizations like the Australian Medical Association, where they make statements that they support collaboration and not fragmented patient care. I don't see any reason why nurse practitioners operating in primary care settings can't provide collaborative care with the entire patient care team, including the physicians that might be needed to help that patient. So that's my feeling on this. I know that many of you agree with me, probably most of you agree with me, but I just wanted to let you know, and if you know a nurse in Australia, provide them a little bit of support and kudos for moving forward down this path. I think they may be headed beyond as a nation, where we are standing right now with our nurse practitioners as primary care providers. There are still many states that restrict what nurse practitioners can and can't do compared to primary care physicians. And we'd like to see that continue to grow in scope so that nurse practitioners can continue to provide the services needed by their patients. Finally, it is the 12th of November as this was released, and that makes it the day after Veterans Day here in the United States, where we recognize all of those who are currently serving in the military or who have recently served in the military. We also honor, of course, our military servicemen and women who have passed away, but that's more of a Memorial Day thing here in the U.S. Veterans Day is for those people that are still with us, both serving actively and retired. And, you know, I think that this is a great opportunity for us to recognize all of the men and women who serve as Army, Navy, Air Force, nurses in all of the armed services here in the United States. They provide a valuable service to the soldiers on a daily basis, providing them basic and advanced health care to them in all sorts of settings, from primary care all the way up to advanced trauma care near the battlefield. So it is certainly something that we want to keep in mind. And for all of you that are veterans and nurses, I want to tip my hat to you here, my cap actually, my nursing cap, and offer you my thanks for your service to our country and your service as a nurse to the servicemen and women that you took care of in your time in the service. I did provide a link in the show notes to a page over at discovernursing.com where there are links to many things about military nurses, including nurses in all branches of the armed services. So follow up on that link in the show notes. And again, go to nursingshow.com, click the show notes link right at the top of the page, and then go ahead and follow the links for this episode. And of course, the most recent episode will show up first. So if you're listening to this a few weeks later, you'll just need to scroll down to where this episode is. And you can find that link to the Discover Nursing page on military nursing and follow those other links to different articles and information about our armed services nurses here in the United States. And for all of you out there, happy Veterans Day. Time now for this week's tip of the week, and we're going to jump in and talk a little bit about complete blood count labs, CBCs, and a little bit about differential, but that's really another whole episode. Now, we could spend a lot of time on each one of these tests and talk in depth about what each test's high or low values might indicate, but this is going to be a broad overview. I do, however, provide additional links, as always, in the show notes, and I urge you to follow up on those links in the show notes for this episode, where you'll find links to sites like the National Institutes of Health, as well as links to medicinenet.com and other sites that will provide you definitive information on what to look for with regard to CBC labs in your nursing care and understanding a little bit more about what these mean in your everyday practice as a nurse. So let's jump on in to that segment now. Now, first off, what are we talking about with a complete blood count? We're going to be looking at which tests are in the CBC. So a complete blood count, what does that mean? What tests are we likely to see? Also, we'll be looking at the differential in slight detail. And of course, differential refers to the various white blood cells that could be accumulated in the count and breaking that down a little bit more. Also, specific markers and values will be defined, especially specifically for the red blood cells, and looking a little bit more in depth at some of the tests that are involved there and what they may indicate. And then finally, nursing considerations associated when you're taking care of patients that are having complete blood count labs and what you need to look for pertaining to different aspects of patient care and what they might mean. So let's look at this. The CBC tests for, first off, the number of red blood cells, also the number of white blood cells, and the total amount of hemoglobin and the percentage of blood composed of red blood cells. The last two are the hemoglobin and the hematocrit. Now, they also may include platelet count and usually include red blood cell indices that are more in-depth looks at the specific composition of the red blood cells present when counted. So as the differential, if you have a CBC with differential, the differential would be a more in-depth look at the white blood cells. Specific types of white blood cells may indicate certain types of infection. The same thing is true in some regard to the indices associated with the red blood cell count, as these indices indicate certain differences in shape, composition of the red blood cells themselves, and may point to specific problems and situations with the patient's health. CBC with differential, again, just as a review, looks at the percentage of each type of red white blood cell in the blood that's counted. So we might have a total white cell count listed, but we break it down further when you have the differential added to look at each specific type of white blood cell. And that includes neutrophils, lymphocytes, which are, of course, the B and T cells, monocytes, eosinophils, and basophils. We've covered white blood cells here on the show in the past as far as the differential, and you can find that episode if you go ahead and search for white blood cell or differential in the show over at nursingshow.com. You can find that, and I would urge you to follow up on that episode if you want a little bit more insight into that. Of course, we also covered the immune system as well, and so you'll find more about the white blood cells in there and what specific white blood cells indicate when their levels are elevated. Now, the red blood cells, what are we looking at in their numbers here? First off, it's important to remember that generally in adults, males have higher counts as far as red blood cells and hemoglobin and hematocrit than females do. This is largely due to the menstrual cycle and the fact that women are constantly losing a little bit more blood than men do, but their normal values are not significantly lower. So you can keep a ballpark in mind for some of these values. Normal values change from time to time. So what I call normal here is only really good up to the date of my references, and all those reference links are provided in the show notes. You may find that these change. Always go by the values that you have in your facility or your instructional program. Use those as the definitive guide for you. Males, generally, as far as red blood cell count, 4.7 to 6.1 million cells per microliter. In females, that's 4.2 to 5.4. So a difference of about a half a million cells in the count for men and women. And that's, again, not so large a difference that you can't remember a general range, but certainly it can be indicative of what low is for a male or a female, depending on their situation. High values, if you have more red blood cells than would be normally indicated, that can be caused by a lot of different things. Think about the physiology of the body and how different aspects of the body as our bodies strive to maintain homeostasis, let's say it that way. And we try to adjust to changing factors inside the body to maintain an even playing field for all of the chemical processes that need to happen. If we are living in a constant level of hypoxia for some reason, you may have more red blood cells than someone who doesn't. Now, this could be caused by a lot of things. If you recently spent a long amount of time in a high altitude environment, guess what? You're going to have more red blood cells. Now, if you go and travel to the hospital, travel somewhere where you're not at high altitude, and the next day you end up in the hospital, guess what? You're going to have an elevated red cell count potentially because you've been living at high altitude and your body is compensated by providing more oxygen carrying capacity in your blood. Similarly, anybody with long-term lung damage, COPD patients, anybody who smokes regularly, all of these people are, you know, for one reason or another, hypoxic at any given time, and so their bodies have adjusted and have increased the numbers of red blood cells. It may also be a sign of chorpalminol, which is enlarged right side of the heart. And this can be a sign of heart failure. Again, patients compensate for reduced cardiac output by increasing the oxygen capacity of the blood, oxygen carrying capacity of the blood, trying to provide more oxygen per smaller amount of blood moving throughout the system. Finally, dehydration. If the patient is dehydrated, they'll have a larger number of red blood cells in a given amount of plasma. Why? Well, because the blood's more concentrated. Less fluid in the system means that there's a greater concentration of everything compared to the amount of fluid. And so concentration for volume will be different and elevated if the patient is dehydrated. And also, of course, there are patients with disease processes such as something like polycythemia vera. So you can look that up as well. Low values, generally, we're talking about anemia. Also may be a case of hemolysis associated with a recent blood transfusion where typing, cross-matching may have been off. That's why it's so important to maintain vigilance and be very careful when typing and cross-matching patients and then providing blood products. Just be aware that, you know, that can body's immune system reacts very strongly to suspected foreign invaders. And if you've just given someone an increased amount of red blood cells, they may have some level of hemolysis going on. Recent hemorrhaging, if patients had a recent trauma, GI bleed, or something like that, unusually heavy menstrual periods, all of these can cause the patient to have decreased levels of red blood cells. Nutritional deficiencies as well, including vitamin deficiencies, folic acid, some of the B vitamins, of course, iron, all of these can cause patients to have decreased numbers of red blood cells because they have decreased numbers of the building blocks needed to make red blood cells. And then overhydration. Patients who've been drinking too much water, and of course some people do this pathologically, but you can dilute the amount of blood. Again, same number of total red blood cells in the body, but diluted in a larger volume of fluid means that you'll have less counted per given volume, and that's going to cause numbers to be lowered. Hemoglobin and hematocrit, we look at the H&H quite a bit. Certainly can be an indication of where the problem might lie. Hematocrit is the percentage of red blood cells in the blood. The hemoglobin is the total amount of hemoglobin in the blood. Remember, hemoglobin is that molecule on the red blood cell that can carry oxygen, and it's an iron-rich molecule. So there can be things that cause red blood cells to be present, but the hemoglobin levels to be lowered because of things like iron deficiencies and problems like that. Usually the values of the hematocrit and the hemoglobin are about roughly three times, the hematocrit is about three times the level of the hemoglobin. It's one of the ways I keep in memory. If I look at a patient's CBC and values may be off, I still look to see if the H&Hs match up. If the hemoglobin levels, if I multiply that number times three, I should end up somewhere in the neighborhood of where the hematocrit shows up. And that means that at least for cases of fluid levels and things like that, we are seeing the numbers match up for hematocrit and hemoglobin. Women, again, also lower than men. This is related to that red blood cell loss. Red blood cell indices. Now, you see these. This is the MCV, MCH, MCHC. These are all indices that look at the specific composition of red blood cells. Red blood cells live for a specific period of time. They are very uniform in size, except when they are very young and very old. And so you can judge the average age and health of the red blood cells in the system by looking at some of these indices and looking at how healthy the patient is and comparing values of the hematocrit and hemoglobin in these values. So these are used to diagnose specific types of anemias usually, and the lab values may vary from site to site. Some of these are not specifically standardized. They should be more standardized than they are, but different labs do things different ways. Different pieces of equipment test in different ways. So depending on where you are, the normal value will be determined by the type of test that is being used and the way that these numbers are evaluated. So again, look to your facility for specific ranges for these indices. But these are the MCV, the mean corpuscular volume, is the average size of the red blood cell. MCH is mean corpuscular hemoglobin. It's the amount of hemoglobin present per each cell. And the MCHC is the amount of hemoglobin relative to the size of the red blood cell. So all of these things can be compared, and we can determine different types of anemias and deficiencies associated with these specific indices and values. Next up is the platelet count. Platelet count, also part of the complete blood count. Again, these breakdowns that you might see in differential and some of the indices may or may not be present in your lab's complete blood count, but you should still see the major components of the blood, and that means red blood cells, white blood cells, platelet counts. Platelet count is, of course, platelets are the part of the clotting factors in the blood that begin to cause blood clots to form. And platelets are basically cell fragments that have broken down purposefully and are now floating throughout the bloodstream, ready to basically plug any holes. Normal values, 150,000 to 400,000 per microliter. Those numbers can be, of course, elevated or decreased depending on certain systems. Low values, called thrombocytopenia, would be related to things like disseminated intravascular coagulation, leukemia, chemotherapy side effects, and all of these things basically change the makeup of the blood and the availability of these products. And so patients with low values are at increased risk for bleeding disorders and prolonged bleeding from anything. They'll be very easy to bruise. Anytime that they have any kind of bleeding, you'll need to apply direct pressure for longer periods of time and monitor them carefully. Generally, unless they're, you know, very, very low, usually it just means, you know, applying direct pressure longer will maintain and take care of that. But if you're starting IVs, if you have to give an injection for any reason, patients with low platelet counts are going to bleed a little bit longer or bleed more than you might expect than other patients. So be aware of that. Higher values, thrombocytosis is the name for that, may be an indication of anemias, certain types of cancers, polycythemia vera, and recent splenectomy. So all of these can be indications associated with high values for platelet counts. And again, that range is 150,000 to 400,000 platelets per microliter. So just an indication of what that covers. Let's think a little bit about CBC and nursing considerations now. As a nurse, you're going to see a lot of labs, and so this is probably a huge review for most of you, and you know, please bear with me. We have a lot of students listening to this, and maybe some nurses out there that haven't been working in facilities where they get patient labs every day, but certainly you want to pay attention to some things associated with anything to do with blood composition. We want to track very carefully eyes and O's, the input and output on our patients, for reasons that dehydration can severely affect the values in our blood, and dehydrated patients have to work harder to heal. Same thing with overhydration. So we need to we don't want to overload the heart or cause problems for patients that might be cardiac compromised. So we need to maintain that careful balance, and watching our daily or recent lab values for our patients can give us an indication of where that's going. Assess the patients regularly for skin breakdown and bruising. Patients with blood disorders, with values that are out of whack in their bloodstream, let's think about it. The blood is the primary highway for nutrients, for getting valuable perfusion of oxygen and other things to the various cells all throughout the body. We have patients that haven't been turned regularly. We begin to see more skin breakdown. And of course, patients with reduced circulation, whether it's because they're dehydrated, because they have a disease process that's affecting the capabilities of their various cells in their bloodstream, we are going to be more at risk for breakdown and bruising and other issues associated with subcutaneous issues and their skin. So be aware and assess more regularly for these patients. They are greater risk. And again, turn your patients. You know, I think it's something that we have to constantly keep in mind. I'm sure many of us hear it all the time, but it is something that bears a reminder. Also, diet modification for some of our patients, if they are having to take iron pills, these can be very hard on the stomach. So there may be different things that patients will need to do depending on when they're supposed to take iron based on their prescription. Review whatever the prescriber's orders are, but sometimes, as often is the case, they may have a total amount of iron they can take every day. We can sometimes cut those pills in half and do half in the morning, half in the afternoon. It needs to be taken across the course of the day, but it doesn't mean that they have to take it all right first thing in the morning, especially if it's causing an upset stomach. So we may be able to get half the iron in at one point of the day and half the iron in later on. So please be aware of that. And other dietary considerations, increased levels of folic acid. Talk to your patients about, basically more vegetables. It's going to take care of that. Vitamin and mineral supplements may be indicated. You know, we're seeing that a lot of the supplements out there really don't have a lot of value for your patient on an everyday basis. But there are those patients, especially those with specific deficiencies, that need supplementation, or medications that cause deficiencies that need specific supplementation. So as always, let patients know what appropriate supplementation is, and also, you know, what to make sure that they don't take too much of a medication, and vitamins and health minerals and things like that. Food supplements are basically medications when taken as they are, and we need to advise patients not to treat them lightly either. Finally, educate the patient. This is an opportunity for patient education. Why are their levels deficient? Are they not drinking enough fluids? Do they need to adjust the way that they eat and consume throughout the course of the day? Again, comes back to what we talk about again and again and again. Simple interventions can often have the biggest impact on the patient's overall health. So talk to them about proper and appropriate hydration. Provide them little tricks or reminders that they can have with them throughout the course of the day to help them remember to have their appropriate hydration. I know for my dad, who was dehydrated for a period of time, we got him to remember to drink enough water by just getting him a stack of cheap plastic cups that we got at the dollar store. And they were 8-ounce cups. And I just put a stack of 6 of them next to the sink in the kitchen. And I said, fill them up. And, drink them throughout the course of the day. As you go into the kitchen, they'll be sitting right there to remind you. Take them off the stack, drink a cup, and then put it in the dishwasher. And then at the next morning, when you empty the dishwasher, the cups are clean, you're ready to start over again. It worked very well for him. It was just a visual reminder. Little things like that could go a long way. So I urge you to think about those things in light of your patient care. Here are some of the resources that are discussed in this episode, and I would urge you to check out and follow up on the resource links in the show notes as well. And of course, if you're a member over at nursingtopstudent.com, you'll have this video segment available there, and of course, same and similar resource links and additional resources will be available for you there as well. I'm Jamie Davis. I'll be back again with more tips like this one. In the meantime, check back here at nursingshow.com or over at nursingtopstudent.com. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I want to thank everybody for checking out the show this week and urge all of you to head over and check out the additional resources you'll find over at nursingshow.com. Of course, there's a link for the show notes right at the top of the page, so you can find the most recent episode listed under that link, and you can go ahead and scroll down to find previous episodes. And I would urge you to get over there and check out these things. I can only talk about the news items and the tips for a brief period of time, really too brief to go too far in depth here on the show. So it's your job to apply the basic things I cover and then understand the more in-depth knowledge and resources that links that I provide for you. And then you can apply them to your specific nursing practice or instructional guidelines and make use of them. If you'd like to get back in touch with me, of course, you can always leave a comment over on the Nursing Show site, and I look forward to hearing from you that way. Of course, every time you leave a comment there, it shoots me an email so I can respond back in the comments, and it's a great way to share things with the listeners. You can also always send me an email directly to nursingshow@gmail.com, and I would urge you to do so. I love to hear from you, whether it's comments, suggestions, corrections on something I've misspoken about, any of those things. Definitely want to hear back from you, and I do respond to each and every email. So, you know, give me a day or so, but I should respond back to you and let you know I got the email and maybe a short answer back for you. The other thing is, I wanted to remind you, I actually am doing a new program. I'm actually working with the Johnson & Johnson Campaign for Nursing's Future, and I will be producing for the next few months, and possibly longer, a podcast to be a companion item to go along with their monthly newsletter over at Nursing Notes. So I would urge you to check out the podcast over there. I'm very proud of it. I'm happy to be working with them. They're a great program, and you can find more over at nursingnoteslive.com. That'll actually take you to their Facebook fan page, and there are links there that will take you to the recent podcasts that I've produced. I produce two every month to go along with the email newsletter, and it just covers some of the topics and interviews a nurse under that topic area every month. This past month, I had an opportunity to talk to Kim McAllister from over at the Emerge blog and interview her. She was their get-to-know featured nurse for the month. And I also got an opportunity to interview several nurses and other healthcare bloggers over at Blog World in Las Vegas in October, and you can listen to some of those things over in the podcast over at nursingnoteslive.com. I urge you to check that out. They're only about 20 minutes long each, so great little addition to your nursing podcasts each week. Of course, also don't forget to check out the Insights in Nursing podcast, where I bring together a panel of online nurse leaders every single week, and we talk about what's been going on that week in the world of nursing and healthcare. And you can find that podcast over in iTunes and also over at insightsinnursing.com. That'll be it for me here on The Nursing Show. I want to thank you all for checking out the show, and let's wrap up with some PodSafe music. This week, we're going to close out with a song by Johanna Staley. Played her music here before, and this song in particular as well. I'm not perfect. Everyone knows I'm not perfect. Ask my wife. And certainly, if I make mistakes, I expect you to correct me, but you know, this is a great song, one of my favorites from Johanna, and I urge you to check it out and follow the links in the show notes for her songs and let her know you heard it here on The Nursing Show. I'm Jamie Davis. I'll be back again next week, every Friday, with another episode of The Nursing Show. And in the meantime, please remember to stay safe and stay tuned here to The Nursing Show. Take care.